Our next speaker is probably someone who doesn't need much of an introduction. I'm sure you've all heard Bob Priddy. He's the news director at MissouriNet, and I know I get lots of my news from MissouriNet, and always enjoy working with them. He's been with MissouriNet for more than 30 years and is an author of, I believe, 4 books on Missouri history, and always just a great storyteller and always a pleasure to listen to. So with that, Bob Priddy.
It is good to be with you. Thank you for the invitation. I enjoyed lunch. Excellent food, and gee, I wish I could stick around for more, because I understand one of the things you do here is eat. I want to thank all of you for sticking around. My first thought was, when I was asked to speak on the history of Missouri agriculture, that would be one that would empty the room pretty quickly, but thank you for being here. I came across a letter not too long ago that was dated April 14, 1789, and it was signed by 8 pioneers who had crossed the Mississippi River to establish a new community in what was then Upper Louisiana. This is what some of the letter said. The territory west of the San Francisco River is of the most desirable quality for corn, tobacco, hemp, cotton, flax, and indigo, although according to the opinion of some, it is too rich for wheat. We truly believe there is not a single arpent of uncultivable land, nor does it show any difference throughout the space of 1,000 square miles. This new community they were putting together would have wide streets. Trees would be preserved because trees needed to be saved for the health and recreation of the citizens of the new town. 12 acres would be set aside in the center of the community to be used as a city park. A ground plot 1.5 acres and a lot of 5 acres outside the city will be given to each one of the first 600 settlers, the letter said. And then further it said, it has been resolved to measure out 1,000 farms, which will be in brief for the settlement of all the families who will come here after the next autumn. The months of September, October, November, December, and January are the most convenient for coming hither, because then the farmers can begin to plow their fields and can continue working until Christmas. The letter was sent back to investors in Pittsburgh by the men who were creating the first American settlement in what is now Missouri. Spain controlled this area then, which is why you hear the reference to the San Francisco River, which we now know as the St. Francis. The community was named for the capital of Spain, Madrid. We pronounce it differently here, New Madrid. Founding a community and making land available just outside it for farming areas for the residents of that community were not at all uncommon in early Missouri. A lot of the people who came here found no hard line that separated consumers from growers. Whatever you might do for a living as a citizen in town, you also had to be a farmer, raising your own food or helping raise food for the rest of the community. In those early years, things were reversed from the way they are now. People with jobs in town had to farm. Today, of course, many people who farm have to have jobs in town. The situation is reversed, of course, but the heritage, the link between town and farm in Missouri remains strong, as strong now today as it was then, if not stronger. The idea that communities could be formed with land set aside for people to farm was hardly new to America. Common fields had existed in Europe for centuries, and they were brought to this continent with the early settlers. One of the most famous of the common fields that still exists today is Boston Common, in one of the cradle cities of our country. It's a city park now, but in its very early days, Boston Common was a pasture where the residents of the community kept their cattle in a common area. When Missouri's first permanent settlement, St. Genevieve, was founded in the late 1740s, about 3,000 acres of land to the west of the small cluster of stockades that made up the community was set aside for farming. It was not a common field per se in that everybody had unlimited access to it, as the cattle pasture of Boston Common was, but it was divided into arpents. About 192 feet wide is an arpent, and it stretched a long ways, each parcel did, to a limestone bluff some distance away. There were individual fences that separated one tract from another. In fact, there were some pecan trees that were planted in this area, known as Le Grand Champ, the big field, to mark lots and lot lines, and some of those trees still stand these 260-some years later. The citizens of early St. Genevieve planted corn and wheat and oats and barley, tobacco and flax and pumpkins. Henry Marie Brackenridge, who was Missouri's first author, wrote once that the crops were planted and then little was done until it was time to harvest. He wrote, "All the husbandry required is to stir the ground slightly before it is sown, which will alone suffice to produce an excellent crop." At least once, however, the wheat grown in the big field was not enough to sustain the village, so additional supplies had to be imported, no matter how good the ground was, or at least how good it was to those who wanted to promote Missouri as a place for settlement, as Brackenridge did. Outside that area was another area set aside called the Domaine du Roi, which was the property of the king, land held in common in the name of the king. And it was there where the people's cattle and horses and sheep, all carefully branded, they were kept in that area in common. Sometimes they roamed around and even roamed into downtown St. Genevieve. The second oldest permanent settlement of Missouri is where you are meeting today. And it, too, had a commons. In fact, it had three. And they're not too far from where we are sitting now. We are sitting in an area that was the original location of St. Louis. And just to the west of us, there were three common areas on what was then a broad, open prairie where you could ride for miles. And each early settler got three lots of land when they came to St. Louis. One was a plot of land here in town. The other was a land that was in the prairie to the west. As was the case at St. Genevieve, the lots were one arpent wide, but very long. And in fact, there were some places where you would have a 192-foot wide lot that extended for a mile and a half. The third lot was what they called a barn lot, and it was about 150 square feet, and it was used to store produce and grain. A few segments of these common fields remain. Here in St. Louis, for example, and the common fields began not far from where we are. Here in St. Louis, if you go out to the Missouri Botanical Gardens, you will be in one of the common fields, or what part remains of one. Lafayette Park is also part of St. Louis's common field, or Lafayette Square. Spain aggressively recruited farmers to come to this territory in the late 1700s. In fact, Spain promised huge land grants to American farmers who would come here if they would become loyal Catholics and become loyal Spanish citizens. They gave them land grants, but they gave them more. Here is what the government of Spain promised Missourians who would come to this territory so that they could live here and they could be successful farmers. This is what Spain thought it took to be a successful farmer in the late 18th century. A barrel of corn, an axe, a hoe, a scythe, a spade, a hen and a rooster, a two-month-old pig for every family. Anything else you had to get yourself, but the government would subsidize you with this to get you started as a farmer. The great agricultural emigration to Missouri really didn't begin, though, until after we became American territory in 1804. And there were a lot of rumors that this land, that this new American territory was so rich as a land that you could plant a 10-penny nail at night and harvest a crowbar in the morning. That kind of stuff excited the folks back east who were tired of raising 140 pounds of rock to the acre, and they decided they wanted to come out here and settle. It set up some sales policies, and there were some confusing land policies because we had Spanish land grants and French land grants and all kinds of other stuff going on. It brought speculators to the area, and before too long, the speculation and the uncertainty of the land policy caused a huge depression. It was part of a national depression, but here on the frontier, it was felt especially hard by these early settlers who had invested so much to come out here and now found what they had invested in was almost totally worthless, and they had been all but wiped out. It took an act of Congress and later an act by what was then a new state of Missouri to get things straightened out and to help out the Missouri farmers. It didn't take long for the people who came to the frontier to realize the value of a collective effort. About the time Missouri became a state in 1821, the first of the Farmers and Landowners Collective Societies was formed so that farmers and landowners could work together in agriculture. It was during these hard times that Missouri producers, including farm producers, exported their first products to a foreign country. When entrepreneur William Becknell rounded up some associates in Franklin, Old Franklin, Missouri, out by Boonville, to take Missouri goods, including agricultural goods, to Santa Fe. In what was then Mexican territory, not American territory. And that was the first time that Missouri agricultural goods were exported in any kind of a coordinated effort to a foreign country. Our exports of Missouri agriculture products date from that time. They took our products to New Mexico, and the people there welcomed them and bought them at amazing prices. And so when Becknell and his group came back and others went down there in what became a burgeoning industry, they brought back gold and silver from Mexico that were very important as a huge economic boost to the farmers of western Missouri on the frontier in those days when banks either did not exist or were so shaky they could not be trusted. They provided not only an economic boost, but they encouraged widespread settlement of western Missouri. And that fed upon itself as cattle growing became important in that part of the state. Why? Because when the settlers left Independence and Kansas City or Westport bound west, they had to take food with them. They had to take livestock with them on their way to Oregon or California or Colorado. And where would they get that? They would get that from Missouri farmers, the cattle raisers in the early days in western Missouri. They would buy their flour and their pork and their other products that were produced by farmers in Missouri, especially western Missouri, for that long trek west. But we paid a price. Because as the West developed, the West had to have a place to ship its materials to for distribution to the East, and it came to Missouri, especially Texas cattle. Starting in the 1850s, huge herds of Texas cattle came to Missouri, and they brought with them disease. And it almost wiped out Missouri's cattle herds before the state of Missouri closed its borders entirely to any cattle from Texas so that we could recover. We were hard hit by that in the 1850s, the Spanish or the Texas fever that came up here with the cattle herds from Texas. Marketing the produce was a lot different then, of course, too. There were a few good roads, and rivers were about the only way to move your products out to St. Louis and then out to the west. And so that meant that farming development didn't really happen too much until the railroad arrived and expanded the opportunities to move goods in and out of interior Missouri. Equipment was crude. Agriculture science was often a matter of myth. I came across this piece of advice. Any of you who might have peach trees, pay attention to this. This is from the 1840s or 50s. If you have a peach tree that is not doing well, wash its roots in warm, soapy water, and next year you'll have a great crop of peaches. Salt was considered a good fertilizer. One publication had this recommendation for curing a fistula on a horse. Find a large, warty toad. Rub its back slightly over the affected part and continue to rub it thus for an hour, by which time the toad will be dead and should be buried. Now, there were those who pioneered in those days a more legitimate form of agricultural research. They were the beginners of the agricultural research that is so much a part of our industry in Missouri today. John Hardeman Walker came here from Tennessee, and he laid out a formal garden in the area west of Franklin, and it was there that he made calculated experiments with various plants to find out what plants would work in this climate, what plants grew best in this area. General Thomas Smith came here in 1826, just 5 years after we were admitted to the Union, and bought some prairie land in Saline County, not far from Napton, and he built what amounts to Missouri's first experimental farm. He destroyed in his work there the long-held myth that corn will not grow where trees won't grow. He proved that farmers could indeed grow good crops on the prairie if they could break the sod, not just in the fertile river bottoms. One reviewer in 1837 said that Smith began a new era in Missouri, and ever since, intelligent farmers have regarded a prairie farm as the best in the world. Southern-style plantations developed along our great rivers. They grew hemp and tobacco. In fact, in 1849, the farmers in Howard and Sheraton counties shipped out of Glasgow on the river tobacco and hemp that filled 5,200 hogsheads and more than 4,000 boxes. The first thoroughbred stock was imported to Missouri in the 1830s. As I said, the coming of the railroad opened up much of the interior of Missouri. The push west gave cattle farmers more opportunities to grow. We were already a place known for fine horses, and more fine horses were developed, especially in central Missouri, where they still take great pride in their heritage in the horse industry. New and scientific methods of farming came to Missouri in the four decades between 1830 and 1870, when thousands of German immigrants came here and established fruit and grape production along the Missouri River. It was here that a man by the name of Hermann Jaeger, who was a Swiss immigrant, began crossing Virginia grapes with the Ozark wild grapes and produced a new breed. And when the word came to this country that the grape crop in France was endangered by phylloxera, he took this new crossbreed grape from Missouri and he shipped 17 carloads of cuttings to France. And those cuttings saved the French wine industry. He was given the French Legion of Honor for saving France's grape industry, in fact. He grew all of this down around Neosho. We were slow to understand, though, that we couldn't continue to take from the land and not give something back or give the land time to heal. Missourians, being hard-headed, as we sometimes are, have to learn things the hard way, and we have in agriculture time and again. In 1851, a farmer in Cooper County by the name of Joseph Ormrod wrote a paper criticizing what he called the miserable system of farming steadily pursued by 8/10 of all farmers in this country, a system he described as taking as many crops from the land with as little manure as possible until the productive powers are exhausted and then emigrating to another part of the country. And he warned that such practices eventually would make the fertile prairies barren. We didn't even have a state board of agriculture for more than 40 years after we became a state. One was not organized until 1865. Its first report issued in 1866 said that Missouri farmers operated a system of depletion and constant drawing of wealth from the soil with little or no effort to secure continued fertility. It recommended several things be done to make Missouri more profitable. It also said that Missouri agriculture was only beginning to recover from the war. And it also had to work to make the transition in many parts of the state from a slave labor system to a new system in agriculture of free labor. The science of agriculture was not recognized except on an individual basis as a statewide issue until Congress granted Missouri some land to underwrite a school of agriculture at the University of Missouri under the Morrill Act. In 1858, the first course of agriculture was taught at the University of Missouri, 1858. And it only lasted a short time. One source says that it died like a seed on a rock. But 3 years later, in 1861, on the first day of the legislative session, a grand convention of farmers was held in Jefferson City. The convention's purpose was to press upon the attention of the legislature the need for a state policy of aid to agricultural education and the establishment of a state board of agriculture. And it finally happened in 1865. In 1863, the legislature established the state board. The School of Agriculture was not actually established at the University of Missouri until 1870, almost a half century after we joined the Union. The first six students enrolled that year, that fall. The professor of agriculture, and notice I said the professor of agriculture, was George C. Swallow, who taught that brief course in 1858 and was still around in 1870. But at the time, there were no textbooks on agriculture, nothing on science of agriculture technology. There was no research underway. There was no research farm of any kind. And for that matter, Swallow was not even trained in agriculture. In fact, he taught comparative anatomy and physiology at the medical school. Not until Jeremiah Sanford became the dean of the College of Agriculture a dozen years after its founding was somebody on the faculty actually there who had a strong background in agricultural education and agricultural training. Our first agriculture experiment station in Missouri came in 1888, financed by a federal grant. In the late 1800s, we had a powerful 1-2 punch in Washington, D.C., working for agriculture. Norman J. Coleman was a lawyer from here in St. Louis who was a newspaper publisher. And William Henry Hatch was a congressman who was from Hannibal. He fought the tobacco trusts. He supported one of the first meat inspection bills, one of the first pure food and drug bills. He helped form the Weather Bureau with his work in Congress. It was Hatch who pushed agriculture into cabinet rank and who worked to see that Norman Coleman of Missouri was the first Secretary of Agriculture, despite those who referred to him as someone who was capable of giving advice only on whether to plant potatoes in the dark of the moon or the sunlight. A book promoting Missouri agriculture published in 1904 for the St. Louis World's Fair devoted 24 pages to the general topic of agriculture, with additional pages devoted to horses, livestock, horticulture, dairying, and poultry. Out of that 592-page book, fully 76 pages are devoted to Missouri agriculture. It covers all aspects of Missouri history and government and climate, geology, mining, and all of this, manufacturing, transportation, education, religion. 76 of those pages indicated how important agriculture was just a century ago. A century ago, it bragged Missouri agriculture had 1/8 of all the corn in the United States, and 10% of all the corn produced in the world was grown right here. One Missouri county outproduced all of the New England states combined. One Missouri farmer produced more corn than was reported in Utah, Oregon, Washington, Arizona, Idaho, Montana, Rhode Island, Wyoming, and Nevada combined. Three counties in Missouri, well, of course, it's not that difficult in Nevada, is it? Three counties in Missouri had grown more corn than Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Colorado, North Dakota, Florida, California, New Mexico, Oregon, Washington, Utah, Arizona, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and Nevada combined. Missouri grew almost three times as much corn as Canada and Mexico combined, three times as much as all of South America, three-fifths as much as all of Europe, and nearly one-half as much as was produced in the rest of the whole world outside this country. The crop exceeded the combined production of 30 states. That's Missouri corn a century ago. More wheat was raised here than in all of the United Kingdom, and two-thirds as much as in all of Canada. Missouri oat farmers outproduced 11 other states and one-third more hay than those 11 states. We were compared throughout this book to other states and other nations. Times do change, and the things in that book are now outdated in many different ways by shifts of economics and production demand. And I'm sure many of people in this room would disagree with the statement in the book that Missouri agriculture never has a lean year. But the pride of the Missouri farmer that was displayed in that book, that is done, and productivity that today's farmer brings from the soil is no less important than it was 106 years ago. And the pride that we should take in the work that is done by the Missouri farmer should be no less than it was then. In 1912, a farmer from Tarkio, who was envied by farmers nationwide for his huge holdings and successful crop and livestock work, David Rankin, wrote, "Agriculture is basic. Upon it rest cities and commerce and civilization. There are great men who lead armies in war or regiments in peace, who succeed in business or statecraft, who write songs or make laws, who add to human knowledge or subtract them from human misery. And the stories of their lives are interesting and inspiring. How much more inspiring and interesting is the story of the life of the farmer, upon whose success depends all the other industries and activities of man." It was about this time that we first began to have university specialists working in the fields with our farmers. The Extension Service in Cape Girardeau County, C.M. McWilliams, became the first county agent who actually was involved in working with farmers on behalf of the University of Missouri. When the legislature agreed to pay part of the cost of operations of farm agents, there was one member of the House who voted no, saying he did not need advice from any young whippersnapper of a college boy, and that nobody from the college could tell him anything about running his farm. He was finally convinced that he might be superior as a farmer, but there were others who were not, and he should support the bill because they weren't as good as he was, and he finally came around, but he still did not vote for it. We were one of the first states to utilize a new technology called radio, to utilize technology to encourage better work on the farm. In 1922, the State Marketing Bureau of the State Board of Agriculture began broadcasting market and weather reports and lectures on modern farming techniques from radio station WOS, which had its studios in the base of the Capitol Building dome. The station's signal reached coast to coast in those days and beyond. It originated its first broadcast of a University of Missouri football game late in 1922 and was the home of the nation's most popular radio personality in 1924, a convict at the penitentiary who came six blocks down the street to play the piano on the radio station. The station lasted for 15 years before it went dark. The Bureau of Agriculture went away during the Depression. And in fact, this year, 2008, is the 75th anniversary of the creation of the Missouri Department of Agriculture. Now, I could go on and on about Missouri's agriculture history, but Katie only gave me half an hour. I really haven't touched on the Little River Drainage District and the reclamation of Swamp East for agriculture, or the development of the agriculture chemical industry, or the dawn of the ethanol age, or the state fair, or the rise in dairying, or the growth of hybrids and genetically modified crops, and the growth of corporate farms and their Jekyll and Hyde image, and so many other facets of agriculture that all of us in this room lived through, and the speed of change in agriculture continues to grow on and continues to seem to get faster. But agriculture is no less a gamble today than it was years ago. The demands upon it, apart from so many different directions, need new initiatives, they need new enthusiasms, they need new insights, and the people in this room and all of the thousands who are outside, back home, on the farm, provide them in the laboratory, in the field, in the classroom, the clinic, or the computer. Mankind's link with the land will always be here with us and will always be expressed best through agriculture, because no single profession, no single craft or calling is as durable as agriculture, and none is as important. I return to David Rankin of Tarkio, who wrote, "In all history, the farmer has been first and most important. The fact that the world is dependent upon him is now recognized by everybody, and he has paid the homage which is due. Possibilities? There is no limit for the farmer, and we do well to tell all we know to the boys and help them grasp the situation, and to be always looking for means and methods to advance the cause of agriculture. We differ in this from all other business enterprises, and I am glad of it." Now, David Rankin said it would be good to encourage the boys to continue the proud tradition of agriculture. In his time, of course, women's role in the business was severely limited. But I think a great progressive, inventive thinker and creative leader like David Rankin would be delighted to see the large numbers of what he might call the girls who are assuming significant roles in the industry that he loves so much. And I think, frankly, he would love to see a woman in charge of the Department of Agriculture. The common field of our ancestors still exists. But as is true with so much of agriculture, it has undergone great change. No longer is the common field a specifically defined parcel of land set aside near a community to provide food for those who live in that town and tend the fields. No longer is the common field a specific geographic area at all, in fact. It is not a place. It is a calling. It is not a field made up of land, but a field of technology mixed with human spirit of those who blend laboratory science and theory with human labor and personal hope. It is a field where common people grow food. It is not a field where common people grow food to feed their communities. It is a field in which uncommon people grow food that feeds the world. Conferences such as this one are good ones for celebrating yesterday's common field in which today's agriculture has its roots, and celebrating the 21st anniversary or the 21st century common field that emphasizes what David Rankin said and emphasizes it perhaps more clearly and with more power than even he could have believed was possible. Possibilities. There is no limit for the farmer. Thank you.
That was wonderful. Thank you so much. I was visiting with in Washington. There was a gentleman as we were debating an issue, and he said, "You know, you never know where you're going if you don't know where you've been." So I thought it was important that we have this historical perspective brought into the conference. So thank you so much for being a part of it.